going to continue now with single particles. Nico is going to talk about a number of refinement strategies. And as some of you might know who have been in the field a while, Nico has come up with a very nice new program called FreeAlign, which does refinement on many of the results that some of the other programs are doing. I think we're not actually going to be teaching FreeAlign during the practicals, because maybe it's a little more than we can handle in the 4 days. But you can talk to Nico about it, and I think certainly many of the people who've been talking about the results here have used FreeAlign, so you should chat to him about it, or you could look up the literature on the program. That sound fair enough?
That sounds fair enough.
Okay, so thanks very much, Nico.
Take as long as you like. It's only lunch.
Okay. Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me. I always like to be on these courses. I've been to the EMBO course a few times also. There they have the beer actually crated up in the room, which is, I think, even better. So next time. Yes. Okay, so Bridget and Clint asked me to talk about refinement strategies of single particle structures, and so this ties in very nicely with where Joachim left off, more or less. I mean, he mentioned a little bit refinement as one of the necessary steps. So what I'm assuming at this point is that I already have a first three-dimensional structure. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about three-dimensional reconstruction. I'm not going to talk about how to get a first structure. I'm talking about how to get this structure to high resolution. So as an example here, I show a AAA ATPase NSF that we've been working on, Johannes Fürst has been working on this and published a structure in 2003 together with the Brunner Lab. And so let's say we have a structure like this at low resolution. I think this was at about 20 angstroms. In this case, we also had an X-ray structure of that represented part of the structure. NSF has three different domains and forms a hexamer. So you see the hexameric symmetry here. And one of these domains has been crystallized in the Brunner Lab and is fitted into the lower part here where we thought it would be located. And so you can see at 20 angstrom resolution that already looks like quite a nice fit. And then the goal of the refinement would be to get this to higher resolution. And we thought we have something like 11 angstroms. I'm going to talk a little more about resolution later in the talk. But what you can see here is that we actually were able to resolve density of individual alpha helices, at least in the outer parts here. And so it clearly went to higher resolution after refinement. So this is one of the goals of the refinement. And then the other one might be, depending on your sample, the separation of different conformations in your particle. And so in this case, we didn't resolve some of the structure, the N-domain. And when you look at the particle in negative stain, you can actually see little arms here that the arrows point to that form are pointing in different directions in different class averages. Okay, so there's heterogeneity in there, and part of the refinement could also concern the separation of different conformations. So I think that those are two goals in the refinement. There might be others, but I think those are the main ones. Okay, so I wanted to start with something that Bob has already mentioned. When we talk about high resolution as one of the goals, it is interesting to think about how far we can go. And so there has been an influential article by Richard Henderson in 1995. And so he looked at the problem, and as you all know, the problem that we have is that of limited dose, so we cannot really irradiate our biological samples with a high dose. That gives us a very clear image, but we have to live with a low dose and very low and very noisy images. And this is really, I think, in my mind, the major problem that we have. All the fancy image processing that we do would be much less fancy if we had really clear images. So he was, he basically wanted to know how many particles you need in order to get to high resolution, and he also wanted to know what the smallest particle is. So I just wanted to say what he said about resolution, and basically he assumed that we would use 5 electrons per angstrom square as the dose, and then demand a signal-to-noise ratio in the final reconstruction of 9 or better, and then and we aim for 3 angstroms, then we would get we would need about 13,000 molecules to get there if we have ideal images. So you already know there are many ways you can degrade your image, and this number is, in realistic cases, much higher. But just to show you that we as a field, I guess, have the expectation that we'll get there someday. Okay, and that will be part of the refinement process. And if you aim for lower resolution, you just need fewer particles. All right. The other point I wanted to make is that, of course, the instruments, the electron microscopes, they are capable of getting us there. This is, as people who've heard me talk before know this. This is a slide that I like to show. This is an indium gallium arsenide crystal, and the little dots that you see here are of the size of atoms. Okay, so the electron microscope can deliver atomic resolution instantly without any image processing, because in this case we deal with a semiconductor, and the semiconductor is much less radiation sensitive, so we can really blast it with the electron beam. And so, as I just said, for biological samples, our main problem is noise. This is also a crystal of bacteriodopsin, and you've already heard that using Fourier filtration, you can clean this up. In this case, we lose something like 90% of the background when we mask out the noise here in between. So I guess the signal noise ratio was something like 1 over 10 in the original image, and we get nice high-resolution structures. And you've heard of this. Okay, so in the single particle case, we don't have crystals. We don't get spots when we Fourier transform. And the crystals, I guess one of the nice things about crystals is it aligns the particles, the molecules for you. In the single particle case, we have to align them ourselves on the computer. And so here I'm just showing which parameters you're dealing with, which parameters you have to refine. And those are mainly, or at least foremost, the 5 parameters that determine the position and orientation in the sample. So this here just shows schematically a carbon grid with a hole, and then in the hole you have an ice layer with particles suspended in it, and then for each particle you have to determine the orientation and how to get initial orientations. Joachim already told you, so in the refinement we just want to get better orientations. Here in the background you see an image of NSF. And then other parameters that are that also need to be refined are the parameters that determine the contrast transfer function. Those are, in the general case, at least 3 parameters. Some people have more sophisticated descriptions that include envelope and so on, but at least 3 parameters, because you need 2 defocus values and 1 astigmatic angle. Okay, so this, in the general case, you would need to know in order to describe the CTF at least. And magnification is certainly another parameter that you would have to know very accurately if you want to go to high resolution. And then something that people have not really talked about much in the single particle field, but we know we have to at least know them, is the beam tilt. That is something that people that work in the two-dimensional crystallography field know that they have to refine. So beam tilt is something that I think nobody has talked about, but is something else that you need to align in the microscope, and to really, you need to know this precisely if you want to go to very high resolution. Okay, so the goal of the refinement is to get very good, accurate parameters for all these. Okay, so in some ways, the refinement is very simple. And it's a crazy idea, which is not practical, but I was hoping to demonstrate what needs to be done. You just assume that you can, when somebody gives you a structure, you can somehow evaluate its resolution. That is an assumption that is obviously not true, but let's say we can tell what the resolution is of our structure, then all we would need to do is take our particle data set and calculate millions of reconstructions. And in each of these reconstructions, we would try out different parameters for all these particles. Okay, so let's say we just deal with 5 parameters per particle. So given enough images, you would get to high resolution. So for example, if we had 3 angles to determine and that we're looking at angles in one-step increments and 2 coordinates, maybe with 1 pixel increments, then we would have to try 5 × 10^11 different orientations for 1 particle. And if we have a data set of 13,000, then we would have to try that many. So that's why it is crazy. Obviously, this could not be done on a computer. But it means that in the end, the refinement concerns finding the right combination of parameters for all of these particles. Okay, and so because this is a big number, we have to take a shortcut, or have to come up with a strategy to still essentially do this. We have to find the right parameters. I mean, that task doesn't go away. It's just that we have to come up with strategies to make this number here smaller, basically. And so the general strategy that I think all refinement strategies are using is displayed here, and it's very simple. So I'm assuming I'm starting with a low-resolution structure, which I use as a reference. So the low-resolution structure is already something I know, and I can now use to evaluate the data. And so this is essentially the idea behind this. Take the structure, and now with a reference, I'm suddenly able to do things like projection matching, as Joachim Frank indicated. Okay, so given the structure, I can now evaluate my images. And I'm going to show you some strategies how to do this. But they all require a reference. And then the hope is, obviously, that when I determine better parameters with this reference, say better XY values and better angles, that I could calculate a better reference. And then this better reference would in turn give me even better alignment. And so this is a cycle, an iteration, that you would go through many times until you don't see further improvement in your structure or in your parameters for the particles. So and then you stop with this refinement. On the side, this kind of algorithm is called expectation maximization algorithm, which is commonly used in this field. Okay, so in a way, you're like, Baron Münchhausen, who is pulling himself out of the swamp because you have something, here you don't have something, and then without any outside input, you have something here. So, it's certainly a very attractive way of looking, attractive procedure because of this. So why is this cutting this big number that we had on the previous slide down? Well, in this case, we're only concerned with 1 particle at a time. Okay, so here we don't ask what are the correct 50,000 particles, 50,000 parameters that determine the 13,000 particles that we had, but we only worry about 1 particle at a time. So then this problem of finding the correct angles is narrowed down considerably. Okay, and now it's manageable on the computer. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about different strategies, how to get better angles. And the first one that Joachim already mentioned is called projection matching. And so what I've shown here are a number of raw images of NSF, and then matching projections from a reference that I have for NSF. And so, as I said, these images are quite noisy. When you look very carefully, you might see why the computer matched this particular projection to this particle. But, you know, it is something that probably by eye you wouldn't be able to do so easily, but the computer manages to find correct projections. And so with a projection that you generate on the computer, you obviously also know the angles and the position that you used to generate this projection. And so then this tells you what the angles and position of the original particle is. So this idea is very simple. So for the refinement, Joachim already mentioned that you would generate a large number of these projections in many different orientations, and then just find the best match. For each particle, you find the best match out of, say, 5,000 or 10,000 projections. So this is one way of doing this. The way I was envisioning it here is slightly different. It avoids the calculation of thousands of references. So as I said, I assume I already have a rough structure, which means that for most particles, at least, I have rough angles. So they are not actually far off from what they should be. And so I don't need to really consider for each of these matches all 10,000 references that I could calculate, but only a local population around the orientation I'm already at. Okay, so that cuts down the computational expense quite a bit. So you know, what I'm saying today is probably not representing all of the strategies that are being used in the field. So this just as a disclaimer. But what you could do here, or what we are doing in the lab, is certainly not to search the entire angular space, but to concentrate around, to test projections with orientations around the current orientation that you already have. Okay? And then you just find a better one locally. Okay, so projection matching. The second strategy would be actually quite similar to the projection matching strategy, but it's done in reciprocal space. So I call this alignment in reciprocal space. And so what I'm trying to indicate here is that you have a reference whose Fourier transform is represented by this greenish ball. And then each of the images that you've collected on the microscope represents a two-dimensional Fourier transform, indicated in blue here. And as you already know, each of these images represents a projection of the 3D structure. So in other words, in reciprocal space, it would be a central section through the reciprocal space. So this section is actually going through the origin here of the sphere. And so now the task is to essentially find a better match of the Fourier transform on the blue plane with the three-dimensional transform represented by this ball. Okay, so again, you would search locally in order to get a better fit. And because this is because these two-dimensional Fourier transforms are essentially projections, if you look at it in real space, it is not very different from the projection matching procedure. Okay, so this would be alignment in reciprocal space, and that is actually a strategy that is used in this program Freeland that Bridget mentioned. Okay, so strategy three looks a little more complicated, and so it would be actually an entire script of operations that you might execute in SPIDER or EMAN or iMagic. So again, I'm starting with a low-resolution structure, and I calculate projections uniformly spaced. Then I use these as references to align my particles. So this is multi-reference alignment, MRA. And then I proceed with classification in some fashion. So there are different classification schemes. I don't want to go into detail how you classify. But so after alignment, you classify your aligned particles. And then you use one of the various ways of assigning angles to these class averages. Okay, this is here. So now you have angles of these classes that belong to these classes, and you can use them to calculate a new reconstruction using the particles in these classes. Okay, and then this reconstruction can be used again to calculate projections and do multi-reference alignment and so on. So you go around this circle, and then there are strategies where you also sometimes don't go around the full circle, but you use the class averages that you get here as new references to do multi-reference alignment. And so again, you know, this has similarity with the projection matching procedure because you are trying to match projections from your structure with particles here, but it also includes classification that the previous slides did not use. Okay, so this is, I think, a strategy that is similar to what has been implemented in EMAN. It's also something that one of the strategies that iMagic suggests to the users. And as I said, classification, I think, is one of the highlights of this strategy. Okay, so strategy four is a strategy that is actually not yet used much in the field. I think Jose Maria Carazo is investigating it, for example. I've also been a little bit interested in it. What I'm showing here has been explored by Fred Sigworth. So maximum likelihood is a fancy name. And so obviously you're calculating some probabilities and a likelihood of your structure given the data that you've measured. These equations are also very complicated and so on. I just want to make one point about them. So you don't really need to understand them in full. I just want to make one point which explains why this approach is not used that much yet. This again describes an iteration where n is the cycle number. So this would be the structure of iteration n plus 1, and it uses parameters and structures of iteration n. So this basically tells you how you have to iterate. So how is the structure n plus 1 calculated? Well, it is calculated by looking at the particles and trying out all kinds of alignment. So this here indicates different alignment possibilities. This P says how likely this alignment is or how probable this alignment is. Okay, so you can see, if you have very good data, this P here would be mostly zero for most alignments. You know, I mean, if you have your particle sitting in one spot and then you try an alignment with your reference over here, this doesn't have a very high probability. So, and so P would be very small. So for good, strong data, P would be probably small or almost zero in most places that you try, except for one particular point where it is very big. And so you can see as you try out all these different alignments here, you would end up only adding one possible alignment of your particle to your structure, the one that is properly aligned with the reference. But for weak data, it is actually an advantage to do this complicated integration, as I'm going to show you in the next slide. So, but what it means here is that you are integrating, you have to try all possible alignments for each of the particles. So for 5 parameters, this is a lot of different alignments to try. So for 3 angles and 2 positions, this would be an integral that it takes a long time to evaluate. And so I think this is one of the reasons why this method is not really used for three-dimensional refinement yet. But as I said, people like Jose Maria are working on ways to do this. And so here, this is just a probability function, but you don't need to worry about it right now. The only thing I wanted to point out is here that this integration, that takes a long time, and therefore you can't do it so easily. And so in two dimensions, you only have three parameters to deal with. You have an angle and x, y, so this is much easier to do on the computer, and therefore Fred Sigwith investigated this approach with a two-dimensional problem. And so this is from Fred Sigwith's paper. He generated data on the computer using the Bakhtiari-Dobson trimer that's shown up here, and he added a lot of noise. So essentially, you don't see your trimer at all anymore. It's really very weak data, I think weaker than what would normally be the case. But he just wanted to see what the limits of this procedure are, and in this case, he can use a noisy particle as a first reference, or a radiation symbol as a first reference, and in both cases, he arrives at the correct structure. And I could show you more slides from his paper. This paper is actually a very nice paper. I recommend you should use it. Read it. He obviously also looks at alignment of refinement methods using the correlation coefficient and not maximum likelihood. And in this case, he does not arrive at the correct structure for the very weak data. Okay, so just a little discourse. I've thought of other places where you can use this nice maximum likelihood method. So this is just a little discourse. Because it is easy to do in two dimensions, you can actually use it to process two-dimensional images of crystals. So this is this projection map of Bakhtiari-Dobson that I showed you in the beginning, determined using the crystallographic methods. And I think what some people might have already indicated when Vincent gave his talk, I seem to remember somebody asked, you can obviously think of this crystal as an accumulation of single molecules that happen to sit in a nice array. But nevertheless, they are individual molecules and could also be processed by a single particle approach. And so I've basically used an image of one of these crystals and cut out the trimer, maybe with a little bit of surrounding material, and then I put all these trimers in the crystal, there were about 10,000 of them, in a stack, and use them as if they were single particles and try to arrive at a structure. So I was using these very noisy particles. I showed you the noisy image of Bakhtiari-Dobson in the beginning. And when you do this, using the maximum likelihood approach, you actually get a very nice projection that looks, you know, very similar to the one that you obtained crystallographically. The big difference with this one is you don't rely on the crystalline order as much as you do here. Okay, so this is a potential application that would bring two-dimensional crystal projects to higher resolution. Okay, so what else do we need to do in the refinement? I mentioned magnification and contrast transfer function. Now these two, the contrast transfer function and the magnification, are a little bit interdependent. So if you try to determine the CTF from a micrograph and you look at these oscillations that you've seen many times now, you always have to tell the program that models these oscillations what your magnification was. Okay? Because the oscillations, this function would look different if you had a different magnification. So this is one of the things you have to tell the program, what was my magnification. So if this magnification is wrong when you're trying to determine the CTF, you will get the wrong CTF. And so these two parameters are a little bit interdependent. And so it is often worth, after refining a little bit, to go back and redetermine the magnification. So this is not always easy, but for example, if you get to higher resolution and have a project like this NSF project that I told you about, then you would have an X-ray crystal structure that obviously has a very accurate magnification assigned to it, and you could use that to calibrate the magnification of your project. Okay, so by fitting the X-ray structure into your EM map, you can then see if your EM map is slightly off in magnification or not, and you can adjust the magnification. That would be one way of getting a slightly better magnification. That's something we do with some of our projects. Of course, you can also calibrate your microscope better with other known structures like TMV and so on. But the point here is you should, at some point in your refinement, check again whether your magnification, as far as you can tell, is the best you can do. And then redetermine the contrast transfer function for all your data, and then continue your processing, your refinement. And just a quick note about determining the contrast transfer function. I've just written two very simple programs that do not really do a sophisticated fit of the envelope and so on. They just look at these tone rings that you've heard about and tries to match them with a calculated contrast transfer function pattern, as you can see here. So on this side, you can see the power spectrum of an image, and on this side, the fit. And so in this case, this seems to correspond quite well, you know, to fairly high resolution, around, I think, five angstroms or so around here. And it might also correspond to tone rings further out, although you cannot see them here anymore. One thing that Joachim Frank told you about is that as you go to higher resolution, you may also want to know or want to refine the contrast transfer function values for individual particles. The idea there was that when you have particles sitting in an ice layer, they can have different heights in that layer, and therefore they sit at different defocus. And so as you go to higher resolution, that may matter. And it's rather difficult to determine the defocus of individual particles, because then you have rather limited signal to noise to deal with. But one other cause of different heights in an image would be a tilt in the specimen. So obviously, when you do this kind of work, most of the time, unless you do random conical tilt, most of the time you would work with an untilted specimen. But it is, as we find it, very hard to actually get an untilted view of a particle, because your holder might be bent a little. Hopefully not, but the carbon film that you use to support your specimen might be slightly warped. People who have already done cryo know that sometimes it is hard to get the grid into the holder, and you have to squeeze it a little, and so it gets bent. So the precise local tilt of your specimen when you take the picture is, I think, not 100% determined. It might be off by a few degrees, say 5 degrees or so. And so if you look at your image, so this square here should represent an image, there might be a defocus gradient across this image that might be quite substantial depending on the amount of tilt you have. And so there's another program, CTF Tilt, that actually tries to fit these kinds of CTF curves locally to the CTFs locally measured in your image. And that would be rather noisy in each individual fit, but at the same time, as it fits these things and also constrains the whole thing to lie on a plane. So it assumes that your grid was at least a plane. Might be tilted, but at least a bit. And so in our case, with NSF, it actually made a difference. We got to even higher resolution by looking at the various tilts that were always small, but still made a small difference in the defocus, and then used individually assigned contrast transfer values for each particle, corresponding to where they were in the image. Because then, you know, when you have the coordinate of your particle and you also know the defocus gradient, you can tell exactly what the defocus at this point was. And so this is something that doesn't do quite what Joachim suggested, but it is a little better than ignoring tilts altogether. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about problems. So one problem that I want to talk about here is that of local optima. So remember, in the end, what you really want to do is to get all the 50,000 parameters that you have for your 13,000 particles, all of them correct. And we decided at the time that I showed you this that if you want to trying everything is too much. You have to do a shortcut. You can only, and the shortcut was to look at each individual particle individually and determine its orientation. The thing is, the total problem is still one of finding 50,000 parameters. So the shortcut didn't eliminate that problem. It just gave a nice recipe to try and do a shortcut. But you still have to find 50,000 parameters. And so I'm just trying to, in this case here, I only want to find two parameters. And so it doesn't represent the real problem, but it makes a point that I wanted to show here. And this is, so if you say you want to find the correct positioning of this particle to this reference, then you would use a correlation map, as Joachim mentioned. And that would, in this case, since it's already aligned, would have a peak in the middle. But let's say your alignment was off. You were thinking you were actually currently sitting here with your position. So then you would try to get a better alignment by finding a higher correlation. So your refinement procedure may wander from this point up to this point. And so remember, in the case that I consider, you don't actually have this entire map. You only have a very local view, because the entire map would be not just two-dimensional, but n-dimensional, where n was this very large number. Okay, so and so then you might, if you don't really know the entire landscape, you could actually get stuck at a local optimum, because as you to get here, you would first have to go back down, and for refinement procedures, this is usually a hard thing to do. They only want to go up and improve the correlation, and would not normally allow you to go back down in between. Okay, so local optima are a problem in the refinement procedure. And this is, for X and Y alignment, this is not a problem, but I just want to use this to make this point. Another problem that I thought was worth mentioning is that of missing views. So again, Joachim told you that one way of getting an initial structure is to use the random conical tilt technique, and I think this is an excellent technique because it really defines the orientations of all the particles very well. It's very hard to make a mistake, and you get a pretty reliable first structure. But it suffers in some ways because you have certain views you never observe. This missing cone. And so here I just wanted to tell you what this means. So let's say here we have our NSF structure, and now we calculate projections of it. So here I know I show you a number of projections, not all of them. I think in total there were about 80 for this particular case, but these projections could now be used again to recalculate the structure. It's very simple on the computer because you know all the angles since you just calculated these projections, so you can do this experiment very easily. But let's say now we exclude certain views. And so what I've outlined here are views that correspond to tilt angles of the structure larger than 60 degrees. Okay, so in your random conical tilts experiment, those might be views that you never observe. And so then, when you just calculate a structure using these views, but not the ones in red, then you get this reconstruction, which now shows this artifact that Joachim told you about. The structure is slightly elongated in the z direction, compared to this one. But say this is now your reference that you obtained from your random conical till structure. And you want to use this as a reference to refine your orientations. So you go ahead and you calculate all sorts of angles for views that you actually did observe and other views that you didn't observe. And you find that the ones that you actually observed come out really nicely. These projections from this structure look more or less like the projections of the original structure, yes, up to here. But then as soon as you hit angles that represent represent views that you did not observe, you start getting into trouble because some of these projections look very different from what they should look like. And so, for example, you could think that this projection that actually should look like this with four strong densities here now looks a bit more like this projection. And you would then assign this angle to something that should actually have angles assigned corresponding to this projection. So you see, you can get wrong angles when you have missing views in your original reference. And I mean, this is, maybe to some of you this sounds a little far-fetched, but I think especially in the beginning, when you start with a project, you don't quite know if you have all the projections, if your data set shows all the views. And so if you don't pay attention to this, so I'm not saying this is a problem you can't overcome, but if you don't pay attention to this, it may give you very strange refinement results. Okay. Heterogeneity, which I mentioned briefly earlier. So heterogeneity is a problem because it leads to various problems in the alignment and reconstruction. So depending on how much heterogeneity you have, you might get misalignment of particles. So this probably won't be the case here with these particles because most of the structure is actually quite stable and there's only a little bit that wiggles around. But imagine other particles that may change their shape considerably, then you can, and you have a structure only for one of these conformations, then you can imagine that you get misalignment errors for other conformations that look very different. So alignment errors might be the result of heterogeneity, obviously lower resolution in the disordered regions, and this is certainly the case when you look at the structure here. We know that the N-domain should produce quite a bit more density here, and which is not seen in our structure, so the density is more or less lost. And also, when you look at the variance of a height or slice number, it goes up around here, indicating that there is heterogeneity. And so, low resolution and loss of features. Okay. So one way of dealing with heterogeneity that Joachim mentioned is classification. And he went through a number of classification schemes. There's, again, one that is based on maximum likelihood. And I started playing with this a little. I've seen that Jose Maria has also started playing with this. He actually published a paper on this. So here are the original equations that I showed you earlier for a maximum likelihood of refinement. And now you can simply add the a further parameter to refine that tells you where if the particle is a member of one class or another. And so, I don't really want to get into a lot of detail with these equations here, but simply tell you about a general difference between this kind of classification scheme and other classification schemes. So very often, so not with the neural networks, I think, but very often classification schemes come up with a definite assignment of a particle to one class. Okay, so in the end, once you've done your classification, you know this particle 51 is in class 6 and not in class 7. But with this maximum likelihood classification scheme, you never make that decision. But you only say, this particle 51 has a probability of being a member of class 6 of, say, 70%, and it could also be with a probability of 30% member of class 7. And so this this sort of soft classification, as I think people refer to it, is quite a bit more powerful, I think, than the ones that do hard assignments. And I just want to show you a little experiment that I did. So I used these Bakshir-Dobson trimers that Fred Sigwith also used in his simulations. And now this is the original trimer. I've masked out a little bit of density that is coming from helix F here. And I've also masked it out in the symmetry-related points. Okay, so it's really a tiny difference between these structures, much smaller than what Joachim showed you. When you calculate the correlation coefficient between these two, it's, I think, 0.98. So they're essentially the same, but not quite. And so then I shift them randomly and rotate them, and then I add a lot of noise so that they look like this. So these are the actual, this is the actual data or the actual simulated data that I used. So you can see there's considerable noise. You cannot really see the trimers anymore. And it would, you know, you would think you would never be able to tell these small differences apart from this data. Because, so this was now your experimental data. So when you start with the first structure or reference, as you want, which is calculated simply by adding up all these particles, in this case I had 2,000 of them, you end up with something like this. It's a little brighter in the middle than at the edge. Just indicates how I displaced these particles. I used a sort of a Gaussian distribution. And then I do this maximum likelihood refinement out of Fred Sigwith, and I get a first structure out that is a mix of these two. So no surprise there, because Fred Sigwith already showed this working with even weaker data. So now the trick is to use this structure and split it into two simply by calculating two new structures with a smaller number of particles that only represent a fraction of your original 2,000 particles. So let's say I use 1,900 randomly selected particles to generate two new structures. So I use 1,900 for this structure, and I use 1,900 for this structure, but not the same 1,900. So in other words, these two structures, even though they look to you like they are exactly the same, they are a tiny little bit different. And then when you continue with this maximum likelihood refinement and classification, indeed you manage to separate them. And they look virtually identical to what you put in, which I thought I didn't expect this to work that well. And I think this is something that could potentially be very powerful. In this case, I did not tell the program what kind of difference I'm looking at. The other thing that is not shown here is if I don't have any difference in these 2,000 particles, but they're all the same, then this procedure also tells me that there's only one class and not two, because then I would essentially have as a second class average just noise. It shows you something, but not really a structure. Yeah, sorry. In this case, 1,000 one time.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a 10
yeah. Okay, here's just a difference map, and if you do this with a more conventional k-means classification algorithm, then this doesn't really work very well. All right. Back to our refinement strategies and problems. And so now I'm getting... so I have still 25 minutes, right? So I'm getting into something that I've been interested in a little more, and that has to do with processing artifacts and noise. And so what I'm showing, or I want to show you here, is what can happen if your image processing produces some kind of artifacts. because of algorithm limitations and so on. So let's say we have a very simple structure here. So this is now just in 2D of a square in another square, and we again apply rotations and translations and add some noise. So in this case, I used a signal noise ratio of 1 over 20. Doesn't really matter. So here I have my noisy representations of this square. And then when I use this square as a reference to align them, I get, and then calculate an average, I get this out. Of course, looks a little noisier than the original, but essentially it looks the same as this. So let's say that now I have some kind of, I have a procedure that I use to do the refinement that includes reconstruction and projection operations, and somewhere there I am producing a little artifact. Maybe it is an interpolation artifact, or I was masking somewhere and produced a little ripple. So now I have a little artifact here that is not really part of the original structure, but it's something that popped up in the reference, and that's the only thing I know, because I don't, you know, unless God gives me the structure, I don't really know the original structure. So now I go in with this reference to align these noisy particles, and sure enough, I get a little replica here of this artifact. And so this is just to indicate that if you have artifacts like this, they're reproduced in the refinement. And you can imagine, depending on the nature of the artifact, this may actually amplify itself. I mean, here in this particular simulation that I show you, it is not very realistic. I just wanted to make the point that if you have something that in the processing that produces an artifact, then you have at some point a reference with this artifact, and you use this again to align the particles, and this very alignment reproduces the artifact. And depending on the artifact, it might actually amplify the artifact. Okay, so this is something that is serious. And so where can these artifacts come from? I guess interpolation errors, which of course you would try to limit. Yep. Yes.
So if you use more particles,
that artifact
gets less.
No. Strange thing is, if you use more particles, the artifact becomes stronger. I will show you this in a minute. So, masking, if you mask your reference or mask your particles, be careful not to mask too tightly, that you cut things off that you don't want to cut off. The mask has to be smooth. You don't want to have any edges in your particles, and so on. So there are a lot of details that, and I think probably not all of them can be covered here in the course. But so masking could be a sort of artifacts. Negative B factor, that's something I'm going to talk about a little more. And then there might be other ways to create artifacts. Okay, so this problem that I just talked about has to do with another problem that I termed noise bias. And so for the remainder of this talk, I'm going to talk a little about noise bias. And so noise bias has to do with alignment of noise to other noise. And so let's say with this symbol here indicates that I want to align this image with this image. And in this case, these images contain just noise. This here indicates the correlation coefficient, not alignment. So let's say I have two noise images, and I want to calculate the correlation coefficient between them. I don't do any alignment. Somebody gives you two noise images and asks you to calculate the correlation coefficient. What would you get as a correlation coefficient between these two images? What do you think? Zero. Okay, so you probably don't get exactly zero, but if you do this n times, and n is very large, you will probably on average get zero. So the expectation value of this correlation coefficient is zero. But in each particular incidence, it will not be exactly zero. Okay? All right, so now another exercise. you have these very same noise images, and you start aligning this one to this one. So this you take as a reference, and this one you align against this reference. So what is the correlation coefficient now? Any idea? Is that one? It's not going to be one, because then the images have to be the same. But it's not going to be zero either, because what you do in the alignment, the very purpose of the alignment is to find the alignment that gives the best correlation. And so you can imagine there are many different ways of aligning this noise image with this noise image. Each one of them gives you a correlation coefficient. And oh, sorry. Poking somebody's eyes out. And so of all these correlation coefficients that you can calculate, this alignment procedure selects the highest. And so on average, you will get something that is larger than zero. And so you can calculate what the expectation value is if you align noise images for a 64 by 64 pixel image, for example. The expectation would be that you get a correlation of 0.064. And so this is a very small correlation coefficient. But remember, if you deal with very weak data, and hopefully you will never deal with weak data like this, you expect a weak correlation, a small correlation coefficient. So the point here is, when you do this, there's no way of telling. There's simply no way of telling whether you actually have some signal in these images that is just very weak, or whether this is really only noise. So I mean, that's an important message, I guess, that aligning two images, you always get something that is larger than zero. Doesn't matter whether it has signal or no signal. Okay. Now, the same is true if one of your images actually is a reference, a proper reference with, a true structure. Okay. And so now the question, you asked the question, what happens if you add more of these noise images? And so if you use David as a reference and then align 100 noise images to his face and then calculate the average, you get this. If you calculate 1,000 images, you get this. So this noise bias shows up more and more as you add data to your refinement problem. And so this is bad because it's counter... normally one expects things get better when you add data. But if your data is very noisy and you're not careful and you have this noise bias, then you think you're getting somewhere, but actually you're making it worse and worse. And so this has an effect on the resolution measurement that people have talked about. Because if you go through this refinement algorithm, where you have your data here and your reference here, and you refine all your particles against this reference, then all the particles are biased to agree with this reference. And if you then use half of the particles to calculate an average and the other half to calculate an average, if they will both be biased to agree with the same reference. That's what I just showed you. So the point is the bias is still there when there is signal. And depending on the signal strength, the bias is weaker or stronger, but it's usually still there. And so by using a single reference to align all your particles, the two structures that you calculate at the end are also biased to agree with each other because they're both biased to agree with the reference. And so when you then compare these two with this Fourier shell correlation, then the numbers that you get out here could be much higher than would be appropriate for the true signal-to-noise ratio of the structures. And so this is what I call noise bias. And so as an example, one of my students, Matthias Wolf, worked on this calcium channel. And here are just class averages and projections from the 3D structure. That's the sort of thing you normally show in your paper. And then here's a three-dimensional structure. And so at some point, Matthias was very happy because the program Freeline, an earlier version of Freeline that we were using to refine this data, indicated a very nice high resolution, 9.2 angstroms. So we looked at the structure, and of course the structures didn't look, I mean, you know, you don't know. Maybe this is the true structure, but probably not. You're laughing, but this is really a problem, because when you are involved and you have worked on this for 2 or 3 years, your way of looking at the structure changes, and you believe some of the features that maybe at an earlier stage you would have said they are not, cannot be true. I mean, in this case, the pore region of this channel is supposed to agree in its structure with the potassium channels that have been crystallized. And so when you look, there's nothing of that sort in there. And so this is, by all we know, a complete artifact. And so this sort of thing, this kind of resolution curve, you can create quite easily, for example, when you use a refinement scheme where you use a negative B factor. Now, do people remember what the B factor was? All right, so the B factor is essentially a number in an exponential that you use to boost your high resolution terms, or depending on the sign of the number. If it's positive, actually you would attenuate the high resolution terms. If it's a negative number, it would go, the function would go up towards high resolution. So a negative B factor would indicate you boost your high resolution terms. You make them stronger. You raise the amplitude. You don't do anything with the phases. You just raise the amplitude in the Fourier transform of your structure. So let's say we have a reference, and now we think we'll get a better alignment if we boost our high resolution terms. So the thinking behind this would be that you have already done some substantial refinement. The refinement doesn't seem to continue. You're stuck. The resolution doesn't get better. And so maybe the problem is that the high resolution terms that should contain the high resolution, the details of your structure are not sufficiently strongly presented to push your refinement to even higher resolution. You see what I mean? So you're trying to give the refinement process more detail so that it can push the particles into even better angles. Okay? And so you boost your high resolution terms, and indeed what you see is an improvement in the resolution curve. And so what I'm telling you is that if you are not careful with this, you can simply boost the noise because of this refinement algorithm. The refinement algorithm is designed to match your 3D structure to the data. And if the data is very noisy at high resolution, then your 3D structure is simply going to be very noisy also. So this is what the computer program is pretty stupid. It doesn't really know what structure and noise is. Yep?
How do you know you're being careful?
Uh-huh. Well, probably something we have to discuss another time, and just saying it's dangerous. I would actually not recommend ever doing it. But some people do it. I'm just a lecturer here. I'm not saying, you can ask me this. So here, I would not do it. But some people do it. And this is the strategy, and I think it's dangerous. So since Freeline was doing this also, not with a negative B factor, but we had other ways of amplifying the high resolution terms, I got interested in this and how to avoid this kind of overfitting. And so here is just a data set that I generated on the computer. Those were two cubes, and here are some representations of images, of projections of this cube, where I applied a CTF and then added some noise. So I had 30,000 of these images with a signal noise ratio of 1 over 50. And then I went through a refinement. So the starting structure was a rough structure. I, of course, I knew precisely the angles and positions because I had generated the data on the computer. But then I added random displacements to the parameters and also changed the angles randomly by about 5 degrees or 10 degrees. So I started with a rough structure and then was hoping to recover the angles and also a better refined structure. And so I was doing this, but I used different ways of aligning the data against the reference. And they are shown here. So I used the phase residual in one case. So here are phases, phase differences between the reference Fourier transform and the particle Fourier transform weighted by the amplitude of in this case, the particle amplitudes. Here, this is a correlation coefficient in Fourier space that Joachim also showed, so that you can use to align particles. And this here is should indicate a weighted correlation coefficient. So these are some weighting terms, and then here you calculate the cross term that you always calculate in the correlation coefficient. And so I had three different functions that I was trying to optimize. So for the phase residual, obviously I was trying to make it small. For the correlation coefficients, I was trying to make it large in the alignment. Okay, and then so the after 10 rounds of refinement, this is the Fourier-Shell correlation that you get when you divide the data in two halves and compare the two reconstructions. And so it looks like the phase residual and the correlation coefficient are performing the best. This is out to the Nyquist frequency of 0.5, 1 over 2 pixels. And so the weighted correlation coefficient didn't look very well, but you can see there is still some problem here, probably because it doesn't go to zero, as Paul will show you tomorrow. This is, in some ways, already an unhealthy Fourier-Shell correlation curve. But anyway, it looked like weighted correlation was performing the worst. There was one thing. Here, this one, when you do the calculations, then amounts to something like summation of the correlation coefficient in resolution terms cubed. Not important here at the moment. So because I had the true structure, I could now evaluate the structure after refinement. And what it turns out that the structure that was refined using the weighted correlation coefficient is the best, whereas the one refined with the phase residual is the worst. Okay, so that just restates this problem of noise bias that and that you have to be careful. And so when you compare this red curve here with this red curve, you see that they actually agree quite well up to a certain point. So there's still some overfitting. You still get a higher correlation Fourier-Shell correlation coefficient at higher resolution than would be justified when you look at the true resolution. Okay. Another experiment that indicates what happens to the noise. So this just shows again how I generated the pictures, projections. I added some noise, and so then this was the test data. In this experiment on the computer, so you know, computer experiments are very nice because you can predict or you can control all the parameters they and they work every day. You know, you can run this simulation 100 times, much higher success rate than cryo. So I had in this case I used the test data and did one refinement cycle using the perfect reference. Okay, so a little different. I'm not trying to get to higher resolution using a first rough reference, but I'm using the ideal reference. In a way, it is the ideal experiment. You're trying to align the particles with a noise-free reference, something that you could never do in the experiment. And so now I'm looking at the result, the Fourier-Shell correlation. And so again, the phase residual, when you use that to align, you seem to get the best resolution. The correlation coefficient and the weighted correlation coefficient both seem to perform not so well. But here is what happens when you look at the actual correlation coefficient of the structure with the original reference. It is best, as you can see, best for the weighted correlation coefficient and again worse for the correlation coefficient and the phase residual. Okay, and then the noise you can look at too. I'm running out of time, so just skip. So because we have the noise as a separate component that we added to our image, okay, so you know, remember, we generate our image by calculating a projection and then adding noise. And then we align the whole thing against our reference. Now I can take that noise component, that aligned noise component, and calculate the separate reconstruction just with the noise component that has now been aligned. So that's something that you can also not normally do with your structure, with your in your experiment, because there you have no way of separating the noise from your signal. But if you do this, you can see how nicely the noise, the aligned noise, now reproduces the reference that you put in. So those are just slices through the 3D structure. And when you look carefully for the phase residual, the features seem to, or the noise seems to have some kind of edge amplification. Okay, so that it's not, doesn't actually look like the reference, but it looks like a reference where the edges were amplified. And that is an indication that you did especially bias and amplify the high resolution terms. So this is what happens with the phase residual. For the linear correlation coefficient, you still get a replica that is a little more balanced, but still very recognizable. And for the weighted correlation coefficient, you have a small replica, but it is much weaker. So this weighted correlation coefficient is actually very, very nice. It reduces this noise bias problem. So the last thing I'm going to say is there's one other little thing that we build into this alignment function. So this, as I said, is the alignment function. The weighted correlation coefficient, when you do some calculations, looks like this, just summation of the correlation coefficient cubed in different resolution zones. And so instead of looking at this, we look at the modulus of this. Okay, so now what we're saying is we don't really care whether we align our structure in phase with our reference or basically align it completely out of phase, which of course doesn't really make sense if you think about it. I mean, you want to align your particles to the reference so that it agrees perfectly and not completely out of phase. Yes? Normally the correlation coefficient that you use does not have this absolute value in there. So why does this make sense? Okay, so if you think about the alignment problem, at low resolution, so you're starting with already roughly aligned particles. So at low resolution, you will get positive correlation anyway. Okay, so there it doesn't really make a difference. You get positive correlation. It really only makes a difference at high resolution, where the correlation gets very weak and can accidentally go to zero or below zero, and you don't really know what is happening. So at high resolution, it makes a difference. So how does it make a difference? If you consider just noise, if you consider images that do not have a signal but just noise, and now use this function to align them and then calculate structures and so on, as you would expect, this function would have no preference aligning your particles either in phase or in antiphase. Okay, so for pure noise. For pure noise, there's no low resolution signal that is already aligned. So the noise images sometimes produce a positive correlation, sometimes a negative correlation to this function. It's always positive. And so sometimes they are aligned with the reference, sometimes they are aligned out of phase with the reference. And so if you calculate a new average, a new reconstruction, actually the reconstruction is not biased in any way. It's not biased to agree. The reconstruction or the alignment of the particles is not biased to agree with the reference in any way, because some particles are biased against and some for. Okay, so the Fourier shell correlation that you calculate between two halves is not showing any correlation for this one. For the other two, of course, it is. But for this one, for this function, it doesn't. So if you have data, it is different. So for data, as I said, you have at low resolution a positive correlation anyway. And at high resolution, the low resolution is helping you to push the alignment in the right direction. Okay? So let's say you're trying to align your particles just with a high resolution signal, it's, which is very noisy, you would probably get no bias in either way because it's so noisy. It sometimes aligns in phase and sometimes aligns in out of phase. But because the low resolution signal is there to hold the particle already roughly in the right direction, you're biasing your high resolution correlation coefficients to be positive. Okay, so you're relying basically on the low resolution frequencies to have some predictive power for the alignment at high resolution. And so that's why I call this a coherence constraint. Essentially, if you have a picture and a signal picture, say David's face, and align that to a reference, then it actually is enough to align just the nose of the picture. Because that automatically, if you align that perfectly, the rest of the image is also aligned. That is what I mean with coherence of the signal. When you do this with noise, you just align on the nose, the rest of the noise is not going to be aligned. Why should it? It's just noise. So this is what I call coherence constraint, and that, again, helps a lot in avoiding this bias. Okay, so this was it. Okay, so the weights, at least in their derivation, have something to do with the signal-to-noise ratio in the particles. And now, you cannot really measure the signal-to-noise ratio in your particles very accurately, but one way of measuring it is to use a correlation coefficient. That is something that Joachim Frank published a while ago in 75, I think. If you have a very good signal in your in your images and you line against the reference, you would get a nice high correlation coefficient or otherwise a small one. And so the correlation coefficient itself is a signal-to-noise measure. That's why when you calculate these weights, this funny correlation cube came out because it contains the correlation coefficient both as a weight as well as an alignment function. Sorry? I'm sure there are even better ways of estimating these weights. So.
Any other questions?
No. Calculations were done splitting the same data set. And have you tried the same Gedanken experiment with sort of independent data sets with different
references? Oh, yeah. If you have completely independent data and do independent refinement, then you don't run into problems like this. But I can tell you, many people don't want to do this because they sacrifice signal-to-noise ratio in their reference. I think the fact is that in the field, people still mostly use one reference. Isn't that correct? I mean, I know that... But that only solves part of the problem. I mean, what I was trying to show here also is that this bias... If you have two separate refinement cycles, then you will get a reliable Fourier correlation. But you will still have this overfitting that stops you from getting to higher resolution. I mean, so a more reliable Fourier correlation is one effect of this weighted correlation coefficient. Another effect is that you get to higher resolution.
I'm anxious to. Thanks very much.